Genesis chapter 46 in your Bibles, the 46th chapter of Genesis. As we move through the book of Genesis, we see God's plan and program unfolding for preparing and developing a people that are going to magnify His name and be the vehicle through which He manifests Himself to the world. As the book of Genesis draws to a close, God's plans for developing and building that people into a great nation are coming to completion. In Genesis chapter 15 and verse 13, God had told Abraham that his descendants would at a future time be taken into a strange land and there be held captive over a period of 400 years. Following which they would come out of that land back into Canaan as a great nation to possess the land that God had promised them. So what we call the Egyptian bondage of Israel was part of God's plan from the call of Abraham. Now, it was part of God's plan from before that, but as far as the unfolding of God's plan and giving the covenant to Abraham and so on, why, that even is presented at the beginning. Now, Joseph has gone to Egypt. And in chapter 45, Joseph has revealed himself to his family. And he has sent for his father, Jacob, and the entire household to come down to Egypt. Joseph tells them that there are 5 years of famine left. So he encourages them, come to Egypt where there's abundant provision, and I'll see that you're taken care of, and you can live here in the land of Goshen and enjoy the blessings of the land of Egypt. So chapter 46 picks up with Jacob's family moving to Egypt. And that's what chapter 46 is about. The first 7 verses talk about the move to Egypt. Then verses 8 to 27 name the family, particularly the immediate descendants of Jacob who went down into Egypt with him. This becomes a key factor because remember, Moses is writing this as he led the people back out of Egypt 400 years later. And here he's going back to that basic group that God had taken into Egypt in the first place. And that small group, 70 basic people, plus others in the group, but 70 that will be named, has become a nation of perhaps a couple million 400 years later. Then the chapter closes in verses 28 to 34 with the reunion with Joseph. Jacob and Joseph are reunited. Jacob's been called to Egypt by Joseph, but I'm sure there was something going through his mind. Does God really want me to go to Egypt? He's accepted the call, but he has to also be aware that there were previous occasions where God had forbidden the patriarchs to go into Egypt. God had promised him, personally promised him, the land of Canaan. And now he's going to take his entire family and leave that land. So as he prepares to leave, having resided at Hebron, he now goes to Beersheba. Beersheba is to the south. Stopped there on his way to Egypt. And in verse 1 of chapter 46, Israel came out with all that he had, came to Beersheba, and offered sacrifices to the God of his father Isaac. Beersheba was a favorite worship spot for the patriarchs. Abraham in chapter 21 of Genesis worshipped here. Isaac in chapter 26 of Genesis built an altar here. And now Jacob stops to worship God and offer sacrifice in this location. And God spoke to Israel in visions of the night and said, Jacob, Jacob. And he said, here I am. He said, I am God, the God of your father. Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt. So you see here perhaps some lingering hesitation in Jacob's mind. Am I doing the right thing? Am I perhaps trusting the arm of the flesh rather than God in leaving the promised land to go to Egypt? Now God tells him, don't be afraid. Go to Egypt, for I will make you a great nation there. I will go down with you to Egypt. I will also surely bring you up again, and Joseph will close your eyes. Back in chapter 26 in verse 2, God had told Isaac, do not go down to Egypt. Similar circumstances in the midst of famine. God said to Isaac, don't go to Egypt. But now he tells Jacob, go to Egypt. That's my plan for building your descendants into a great nation. And you know, God says in verse 4, I will go with you down to Egypt, and I will bring you up again. Now, I think that's important to note because we call the time of Israel's stay in Egypt the Egyptian bondage. And it was, but we ought to recognize it is the Egyptian bondage, which was the will of God for his people. And not particularly a judgment on them. There's no indication here of God saying, I'm going to judge you because you and your family and your fathers haven't been as faithful as they ought to be. No, this is simply my plan for you, to take you into Egypt and build you there as a great nation. And I'm sure Jacob was tremendously encouraged. The assurance in verse 4 that Jacob will, or Joseph will close your eyes is the assurance he'll die in the presence of Joseph. That's a comfort that he's going to be privileged to be with that favored son. And he'll be there with him when he leaves this life. God will bring them up again. But Genesis 15 tells us that'll be 400 years later. Jacob arose from Beersheba, the sons, and they proceed down into Egypt. In verses 8 to 27, you have the family mentioned that go down. And in this list are the actual descendants of Jacob. For example, the daughters-in-law are not mentioned. Only those who are the actual immediate descendants of Jacob are in the list, even though the family group will be much larger. Verse 26 tells us all the persons belonging to Jacob who came to Egypt, his direct descendants, not including the wives of Jacob's son, were 66 persons in all. 66. Now, if you just turn over a few pages to Exodus chapter 1, and verse 5, you'll read, all the persons who came from the loins of Jacob were 70 in number. And you're told there Joseph was already in Egypt. So if you add 66 plus Joseph, Joseph's two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, and Jacob himself, that brings you to the number 70 that you have in Exodus chapter 1 and verse 5. So that's the core group going down there. And 400 years later, they'll come out as a nation of millions, built by God and preserved by God in that place. The chapter closes, verse 28 to 34, with the reunion with Jacob and Joseph being reunited. In verse 29, Joseph prepared his chariot, went up to Goshen to meet his father Israel. As soon as he appeared before him, he fell on his neck and wept on his neck a long time. The last time Joseph was with his father, he was 17 years of age. That's back in chapter 37. He's now about 39 years of age. So 22 years have gone by. And I'm sure there were great changes in both of these men. Verse 34, there is to be a settling of the family in Goshen. And Joseph speaks about their coming meeting with Pharaoh. After he gets his family settled, he's going to take them to meet Pharaoh. First, he'll take some of his brothers, five of them, and then his father personally. What they're going to do is ask for permission to sojourn in the land of Goshen. Not to take that as their own permanent private possession, but to live there for a while, particularly in the face of the famine. Now it says in verse 33, Joseph tells them, it shall come about when Pharaoh calls you and says, what is your occupation? That you shall say, your servants have been keepers of livestock from our youth, even unto now, both we and our fathers, that you may live in the land of Goshen. For every shepherd is loathsome to the Egyptians. Now Joseph has already said that he would tell the Pharaoh up in verse 32 that his brothers were shepherds. Some say that he is now telling them in verse 34, just say you're keepers of livestock. Don't mention shepherds because Egyptians don't like shepherds. But it also may mean that Joseph is including here, since he said that he himself, in verse 32, would tell Pharaoh that they were shepherds, keepers of livestock, that he wants his brothers to share with Pharaoh what their occupation is. And since shepherds are loathsome to the Egyptians will have them, be glad to have them gathered together in one spot, in Goshen, where they can be somewhat isolated, and yet in an area that is fitting for a man of Joseph's position to have his family. That isolation, I think it's important to note at the end of verse 34, every shepherd loathsome to the Egyptians is going to work, if I can use that expression, to Israel's benefit. Because in Israel, in Egypt, for 400 years, Israel will maintain their identity. Now, it would be easy for a family of 66 plus going into a mighty nation like Egypt with a family member who is second in command in the whole land to become assimilated into the land. And after a few years of intermarrying and so on, they would have just lost their identity. But through that 400 years, Israel maintains its separate, distinct identity, part of God's plan to build them as a nation. Well, chapter 47 deals with Joseph and Jacob in Egypt, and their time there in Egypt. First 12 verses, Jacob and Pharaoh, the brothers first and then the father. Then verses 13 to 26 will tell us about Joseph's reign in Egypt. You get some insight into the brilliance of Joseph, and he is the instrument to bring all the land and wealth of Egypt into the possession of the Pharaoh of Egypt. Well, Joseph plays a tremendous role here in bringing all the land of Egypt under the control of Pharaoh and making all the people of Egypt the servants or slaves of Pharaoh. And then Joseph's the promise closes, the chapter closes with a promise by Joseph in verses 27 to 31. He'll promise his father Jacob to bury him in the land. First six verses of chapter 47, Joseph takes five of his brothers, we're not told which five, to have an audience with Pharaoh. And there they share their occupation, and they tell Pharaoh that they are shepherds in verse 3. This caused me to think that they're not necessarily rebelling against what Joseph told them. No indication at this point that brothers would want to do that. They're simply sharing their occupation. And they ask if they could sojourn in the land of Goshen in verse 4. Pharaoh is happy to have them do that. The land of Egypt is at your disposal, verse 6. Settle in the best of the land, live in Goshen. And if you have any that are especially good, have them take care of my livestock as well. Then in verse 7, Jacob is brought to meet the Pharaoh. And I think that this is a striking meeting. Because here you have the aged patriarch Jacob, 130 years of age. God's chosen man at this point in time on the earth. Meeting with perhaps the greatest ruler on earth at the time, at least one of the greatest rulers. And yet the superiority of Jacob is recognized. Now, that's remarkable. You talk about who is great. A man who has had to leave Canaan in the face of famine and starvation, who's had to come down to buy food from the Egyptians, or the mighty king of the mighty empire of the Egyptians. Yet in the face of it, Jacob is the greater man. This comes out because you read in verse 7, Joseph brought his father Jacob and presented him to Pharaoh. Jacob blessed Pharaoh. Verse 10, Jacob blessed Pharaoh and went out from his presence. If you read Hebrews chapter 7 and verse 7, we're told without any dispute, the lesser is blessed by the greater. And here we have God's statement of greatness. Jacob the patriarch is the greater, and he gives the blessing to Pharaoh because Jacob is God's chosen man. And that gives him superiority over all and everyone. Pharaoh is impressed with Jacob, impressed with his age. And he asked him in verse 8, how many years have you lived? Jacob's had a hard life. And I take it the 130 years told on him a little bit. And Jacob tells him, I've lived 130 years, few and unpleasant have been the years of my life. Remember, he started out with problems way back when he was looking for a wife. And in his father-in-law's land with Laban, all the problems that have plagued him over the years. And yet he is God's chosen and appointed man. In verses 13 to 19, you have the first part of Joseph's reign. Joseph's reign in verses 13 to 26. In verses 13 to 19, Joseph takes control of the livestock of Egypt. Now, Joseph is ruling the land, remember. And here we go back to see what he's doing. The Egyptians used all their money. They didn't have any more money to buy food. So now they give them all their livestock the next year to buy food. So all the livestock of the land now becomes the possession of Pharaoh. Verse 16, Joseph said, give up your livestock. I will give you food for your livestock since your money is gone. So they brought their livestock to Joseph and so on. Verse 18, when that year was ended, they came in the next year and said, we will not hide from my Lord. All our money is spent. The cattle are my Lord's. There's nothing left for my Lord except our bodies and our land. We don't have anything else to give. The land and us, and they go together. Because without land to work, the only thing left for them is slavery. They've got to become slaves to someone who has land. So what they do here is bargain. We'll give you our land and ourselves in exchange for food. And so in verses 20 to 26, all the land of Egypt, with the exception of the land that belonged to the priests of Egypt, becomes Pharaoh's land. I think it's interesting here that Joseph, the man of God, becomes an instrument to bring all the wealth and all the land of Egypt and all the people of Egypt into a position of servitude to the Pharaoh of Egypt. And here you see a man of God functioning, in effect, in the world system in a way pleasing to God and yet consistent with that world system. When I first read this, I thought, boy, that's terrible. Joseph becomes an instrument of enslaving the people of Egypt. Doesn't seem like a very high calling for a man of Joseph's character and stature. But we ought to understand, in the ancient world, things have changed so much, but in the ancient world, biblical times, it was understood that a person paid their own way. As long as there were any resources of any kind at all, the final option was they would sell themselves into slavery. But it was always understood, you were personally responsible to make your provisions and make your own way. There was no idea that someone else was to carry me. Someone else was responsible for me. So if it came down to the bottom line, I didn't have anything else but me, I sold myself into slavery. Incidentally, this very practice will be settled in the law of Israel when God brings the nation Israel out. That even the Israelites, according to law, might sell themselves into slavery if they had no option, no other way to pay. Now, they had the year of Jubilee that kept that from being a perpetual slavery from generation to generation. You ought to note here, the people of Egypt are not mad at Joseph about this. In fact, they view him as a savior and as a deliverer. Joseph tells them, what you do, all your lands now belong to Pharaoh. And you now are the servants of Pharaoh. You're working Pharaoh's land. And here's the deal. When you get a harvest, 1/5 of your harvest belongs to Pharaoh. 20% is Pharaoh's, 80% is yours. And that's the way we work it. It's Pharaoh's land, but you'll get to keep 80% since you're working it. And he gets 20%. Verse 25. So they said, you have saved our lives. Let us find favor in the sight of my Lord, and we will be Pharaoh's slaves. So you note here, they are happy. They are pleased. They view Joseph as their savior because he has worked out a plan whereby they can purchase the necessary food and still be able to continue to provide for their families and so on. Chapter closes in verses 27 to 31 with Joseph making a promise to Jacob. Jacob's anticipating his death. And as he anticipates his death, and it's near because in verse 28, Jacob lived in the land of Egypt 17 years. So the length of Jacob's life was 147 years. Now we're going to have a little bit more information before he actually dies. He doesn't die in chapter 47, but he's making preparation for his death as he sees that time coming. And one of the things that he wants from Joseph is a promise not to bury him in Egypt. He makes him promise with that vow where he puts his hand under the thigh. A solemn promise here. At the end of verse 29, please do not bury me in Egypt. Verse 30, but when I lie down with my fathers, you shall carry me out of Egypt and bury me in their burial place. And he said, I will do as you have said. He said, swear to me. So he swore to him. You see, this is a matter of great importance to Jacob, that he be taken back to Canaan and be buried in the family burial plot, the cave of Machpelah. And he makes Joseph swear, take an oath, that he will do that. Joseph, of course, promises, and that's what will happen. But you see here something of the faith of Jacob manifesting itself. He believes that's his land, and that's where he belongs. And he's just visiting in Egypt. Now, in connection with his impending death, we have chapter 48. And chapter 48 is important because here Jacob blesses Joseph's sons. That's what the chapter's about. The blessing on Joseph's sons, which really is a blessing on Joseph, through his two sons. Got a note, chapter 48 is important because when you come to chapter 11 of Genesis, that great chapter of the heroes of the faith throughout Old Testament history, in Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 21, out of all the long life of Jacob, all the experiences he had, all the things that he went through, even wrestling with the angel of the Lord, having his name changed from Jacob to Israel as the one who wrestled with God. You know the event that is selected out in Hebrews 11, 21 that marked Jacob off as the great man of faith worthy of inclusion in Hebrews 11? His blessing of the sons of Joseph in Genesis chapter 48. So when you read Genesis chapter 48, you ought to keep in mind that this is the event that God selects out as the great testimony to the faith of the man Jacob. The first seven verses, Jacob reviews with Joseph the promises that God has given, that he would be fruitful in verse 4, make you a company of peoples, will give this land to your descendants for you for an everlasting possession. There's going to be a mighty people possessing the land of Canaan. Verse 5, and now your two sons, Jacob speaking to Joseph, who were born in the land of Egypt before I came to you in Egypt, are mine. There is almost a formal adoption that takes place here. Your two sons are mine. Ephraim and Manasseh shall be mine as Reuben and Simeon are. So they're going to be viewed as though they were my sons instead of my grandsons. And you'll note what he goes on in verse 6. But your offspring that have been born after them shall be yours. They shall be called by the names of their brothers in their inheritance. So you know what he's saying? That's just applying to these two children. They are going to be viewed as the sons of Jacob. Now, any other children you have, they'll be your sons. They'll be the sons of Joseph, and so on. What he is doing here is elevating Joseph to the position of firstborn. These two sons, in effect, give Joseph a double portion or a double blessing. Remember, the firstborn got a double portion. The double portion of the firstborn is given to Joseph now by having his two sons both be viewed as sons of Jacob. So, in effect, Joseph's two sons now are getting a portion each. This will be developed later. Maybe you ought to jump over there. 1 Chronicles chapter 5 explains why this happened. 1 Chronicles chapter 5. Verse 1. Now the sons of Reuben, the firstborn of Israel. Then an explanation about Reuben. For he was the firstborn, but because he defiled his father's bed, committed incest with his father's concubine, remember? His birthright was given to the sons of Joseph, the son of Israel. You see, the birthright would naturally have gone to Reuben, but Reuben forfeited it by his act of incest. And now Jacob bestows it on Joseph, giving him a double portion through his two sons, so that he is not enrolled in the genealogy according to the birthright. Reuben is not in the genealogy as the firstborn. Though Judah prevailed over his brothers, from him came the leader, yet the birthright belonged to Joseph. We'll get to that in chapter 49. Interesting. Joseph gets the birthright, but Judah really is the leading tribe, and from Judah will come the leader in Israel and ultimately the Messiah. So the birthright does not convey ultimately the messianic right, but it is the place of blessing and honor among Jacob's sons. Come back to chapter 48 of Genesis. Verses 8 to 22, Jacob blesses Joseph's sons. And you remember the importance of this in biblical times. We have seen this with Jacob and his brother Esau, as Isaac gave the blessing to Jacob through the deceit of Jacob. Very important what is going on here. We are passing on, in a formal and binding way, rights and blessings and honor. And Joseph brings his sons, verse 14, and stands them before his father. His eyes now are blind with age. And he puts them there so that the oldest son, Manasseh, is where the right hand of Jacob is, because the right hand will convey the right of firstborn, and the left hand with Ephraim. What Jacob does is reach out and cross his hands. Puts his right hand on Ephraim's head and his left hand on Manasseh's head. What we see here is for the fourth consecutive generation, God passes over the oldest and selects a younger. That happened. He selected Isaac over Ishmael, even though Ishmael was born before Isaac. Selected Jacob over Esau, even though Esau was older. He has selected Joseph over Reuben. We saw that in 1 Chronicles 5. Joseph is getting the right of firstborn here, replacing Reuben. And now in the sons of Joseph, Ephraim is being selected over Manasseh in the plan of God. Interesting how for four successive generations, God bypassed the normal plan in the accomplishing of his purposes. He blessed Joseph in verse 15. And Joseph's here used as a collective term for his two sons. He blessed Joseph by blessing his two sons. The God before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has been my shepherd all my life to this day. First time in Scripture, God is identified as the shepherd of his people. All my life to this day. The angel who has redeemed me from all evil. Here we're talking about the angel of the Lord, and here you see redemption brought in with him. The angel of the Lord has been the redeemer of Jacob from all evil. Bless the lads. May my name live on in them, the names of my fathers, Abraham and Isaac, and may they grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth. Now, there's a problem. Verse 17, Joseph saw that his father laid his right hand on Ephraim's head. It displeased him. Now here you see Joseph, mighty man of God that he has been, but he fails to discern the plan of God as his father Jacob does. And he tries to take his father's hand and tell him, you got it wrong. He thinks it's his eye problem. You know, you got your hands in the wrong place, Dad. This is the oldest over here. And typical parent, Jacob has to tell him in verse 19, I know, my son, I know. Even back then, the parents, the kids didn't think the parents knew what they were doing. Jacob says, I know what I'm doing. I know who is who here. And really, it's amazing to see how God is leading Jacob. And how Jacob knew, I don't know, but God has made clear to Jacob that the oldest here is not going to be as great as the younger. And he says, he also shall become a great people. He shall be great. Manasseh, your oldest son, he will be great too. However, his younger brother shall be greater than he. His descendants shall become a multitude of nations. And he blessed them, saying, by you Israel shall pronounce blessing, saying, may God make you like Ephraim and Manasseh. That's true. Years later, Ephraim will become the leading tribe in the northern kingdom. In fact, the name Ephraim was often used as a title for the entire northern kingdom, the 10 tribes of the north, because Ephraim was such a dominant tribe and people among that, became much superior to the tribe and people of Manasseh. So Joseph has received then the birthright. And you come to chapter 49. Now Jacob is ready to bless all of his sons. So he's taking care of the birthright issue first, passing that on to Joseph, establishing that with his sons. Now he calls his sons together, and he's going to give his blessing, if you will, which is mixed with prophecy for the future for each of these sons and their descendants. And what we'll have here is God's perspective on what is going to happen to these tribes. Much of what is related here will focus upon what will take place when they return to Canaan after the Egyptian bondage, where they'll be settled, the kind of position they'll have in the land, and so on. But some of the prophecy here goes beyond that all the way down to the time of the Messiah when he will rule on the earth. It's amazing the insight given to Jacob here as God is using him to speak of the future destiny that is over 400 years away for these children. He starts out in verses 3 and 4 with Reuben, and we're not going to go into detail on these, obviously, because of time, and some of them we'll just mention. Verses 3 and 4, Reuben. And Reuben was the firstborn. And Reuben becomes an example of squandered potential. You're going to see this in some of the sons of Jacob. Such potential that lay unrealized. Reuben is an example of that. He's a man of unstable emotions. He's uncontrolled in verse 4 as water. Like water that boils. It has no pattern. It has no stability. It's unsettled. He's a man who is unsettled and unstable. He committed incest with his father's concubine Bilhah in chapter 35 and verse 22 of Genesis. He'd fail in leadership because of that condition. Tragic lack of realizing the potential. No great leaders came out of Reuben. No great judges. No heroes of the faith come from the line of Reuben. Verses 5 to 7 talk about Simeon and Levi together. You remember Simeon and Levi back in chapter 34, verses 25 to 29, they slaughtered the Shechemites because the son of the king had raped their sister. But that act of violence and personal revenge hangs over them, and there is no blessing for Simeon and Levi. They're going to be scattered throughout the other tribes. Simeon, to all intents and purposes, disintegrated as a tribe. They were scattered among the tribe of Judah, not really having their own distinct identity. Levi will become the priestly tribe, having redeemed itself somewhat. They'll be given 48 cities sprinkled throughout all the other tribes of Israel. So you see the fulfillment of the prophecy that they'll be scattered. At the end of verse 7, I will disperse them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. That's exactly what happened. It goes back to the character that is revealed here and the punishment on that character. Verses 8 to 12, Judah. This is the most important, I think, prophecy that we have here because it carries us directly to the Messiah. The blessing that's given here is only matched by the blessing given to Joseph later on. And Joseph's blessing does not match the blessing on Judah as far as its prophetic impact and importance. Now, verses 8 and 9, the first part of 10, stress the dominance of Judah over the other tribes. Judah is going to be the dominant. Judah means praise, and so there's a play on words here. Judah, your brother, shall praise you. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's son shall bow down to you. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. He couches. He lies down as a lion. As a lion, he who dares rouse him up. So the lion of the tribe of Judah. Yeah, so dominant and powerful and ruling. And it is the greatest tribe and continues to be. In fact, we speak of the Jews. And that name or title evidently comes from Judah. So dominant were they. In verse 10, you have an important prophecy. And with verse 10 through verse 12, you switch not just to the time when they will be established in the land of Canaan after the Egyptian bondage, but you're carried beyond to messianic times when the Messiah who will come through the family or tribe of Judah will rule and reign on the earth. Verse 10, the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet. The scepter is the symbol of royal power. And so royal rulership is firmly entrenched in Judah. It will not depart from Judah until Shiloh comes, and to him shall be the obedience of the people. Shiloh, the word, probably means, and there's quite a bit of discussion about the meaning of the word Shiloh, but it probably means him to whom it belongs. So what you have here is the scepter shall not depart from Judah until him to whom it belongs comes, and to him shall be obedience. So Shiloh is a title for the Messiah. He is the one to whom rulership belongs. And Judah will maintain the scepter, the position of rulership in Israel, until the lion of the tribe of Judah, the Messiah himself, comes and personally rules and reigns. And then you have a description of that time as a time of prosperity and abundance in verses 11 and 12. They tie the donkey to a vine. That pictures abundance because donkeys ate vines. But there's so much abundance in the land that that's all right. You don't have to protect this vine here because there's overflowing abundance. We're happy to tie our donkey to a vine and have him eat the vine while he's tethered there. Eyes are dull from wine, his teeth white from milk. There's just an overflowing abundance of all things. And I take it what we have here is a description of the characteristics of the millennium. They fit some of the other passages like Isaiah chapter 11 and Isaiah chapter 65 in their description. So a remarkable prophecy here for Judah. Judah will dominate the other tribes, and the Messiah shall come from Judah. Interesting revelation. That's picked up in 1 Chronicles chapter 5, remember? You would have thought that it would come through Joseph, wouldn't you? And especially when he gets the right of firstborn. The birthright, but God's plan is that the line will come through the tribe of Judah. Important prophecy here. Clarifies for us where the Messiah will come from. Verse 13, Zebulun. Verses 14 and 15, Issachar. Issachar is going to possess, when they get back into Canaan, that fertile plain of Esdraelon, the plain of Jezreel, that we call the plain of Armageddon. Fertile area, but an area that was constantly invaded because of its position. The invaders of the land would come through this valley area. And so Issachar was constantly subjected by invading peoples. Verses 16 to 18, you have the tribe of Dan. Now, Dan has said that it would be a judge of the people of Israel. He would judge his people. Verse 16, Dan shall judge his people as one of the tribes of Israel. And that would be partially fulfilled in the life of Samson. Remember Samson, one of the judges of Israel? He ruled Israel for 20 years. Judges 13, verse 2 tells us that he was of the tribe of Dan. So that's a literal fulfillment there. But Dan also fails to live up to its potential. So it's described here as a snake, by the way. Treacherous, violent. It lacked moral commitment, this tribe. In fact, in the time of the judges, formal idolatry, the first major practice of idolatry, Judges chapter 18, is initiated by the tribe of Dan. So it is used to draw Israel away from its God. It's a treacherous tribe. And interesting, in Revelation chapter 7, verses 5 to 8, when you have the list of the tribes of Israel, the tribe of Dan is the only tribe missing. There's been a lot of discussion about that. Some believe that the Antichrist comes from the tribe of Dan, or the false prophet, and therefore Dan is omitted. It's a good guess. What we do know about it is Dan was the initiator of idolatry in the land of Israel. Another one that had potential to judge and to rule, but that potential was lost by its treacherous character. Verse 18, Jacob interjects a statement of faith here. For thy salvation I wait, O Lord. Perhaps after he's going through his sons here, he realizes it all depends on God. His sons aren't, going to be able to do it. But a reminder here, I'm waiting for your salvation, God. We're talking about the future of my family, the nation that will come from it. But salvation is from God, and I wait for your salvation, O Lord. Verse 19 is Gad. And we're told, as for Gad, raiders shall raid him, but he shall raid at their heels. And what happened, Gad settled, remember, in the Trans-Jordan River on the east side of the Jordan. And that put them in a position of vulnerability for all the foes of Israel. So they were a constant battleground. Verse 20, Asher. Verse 21, Naphtali. Verses 22 to 26, Joseph. And the picture here is one of growth and prosperity for Joseph. There'll be hostility, but he'll overcome the hostility and continue to grow and prosper. So extensive blessings promised to Joseph. And they would come through the tribes known as Ephraim and Manasseh. Truly great peoples, particularly Ephraim. The last son to be blessed is Benjamin, the other child of Rachel, Jacob's favored wife. Benjamin is a ravenous wolf. In the morning he devours the prey. In the evening he divides the spoil. Benjamin's compared to a wolf here, probably because of his violent, warlike character. He's a ravenous wolf. And the tribe of Benjamin was a violent tribe, a warlike tribe. Great warriors in the tribe of Benjamin. Some great men came from the tribe of Benjamin. The judge Ehud in Judges chapter 3, verse 15, came from the tribe of Benjamin. The first king of Israel, Saul, was a Benjamite. The son of Saul, of course, Jonathan, great man of God, great warrior. And that great New Testament warrior, the Apostle Paul, was of the tribe of Benjamin. And you appreciate in Paul his scrappiness. Well, he came from a tribe that was characterized as being battlers or fighters. Verses 28 to 33, we have the death of Jacob. He has given his blessing to his family. He is laid out by the revelation of God. Something of what the future held for each of his son's descendants. And interesting to see how that worked out then as they moved back into the land. Going even in some cases, particularly Judah, to the time of the coming Messiah. Now, Jacob is ready for his coming death. And he reiterates to Joseph that he must not be buried in the land of Egypt. He charges his sons with taking him back to the land. Verse 29. He charged them and said to them, I am about to be gathered to my people. bury me with my fathers in the cave that is in the field of Ephron the Hittite, in the cave that is in the field of Machpelah, which is before Mamre in the land of Canaan, which Abraham bought along with the field from Ephron the Hittite for a burial site. There they buried Abraham, his wife Sarah. There they buried Isaac, his wife Rebekah. There I buried Leah. That's where I want to be buried. Back in the family burial cave, in the land that God has promised. Genesis chapter 50. And if I'm going to say what Genesis 50 is about, it's the death of Joseph. Now, that's how the chapter concludes, but that's the major event. The first 14 verses deal with the death and burial of Jacob. Then you have a speech by Jacob in verses 15 to 21 on the providence of God. And Jacob gave some mighty talks on the providence of God, and this is one of them. And then verses 22 to 26, the death of Jacob. The burial of Jacob, first 14 verses, he dies and he is embalmed according to the practice of the Egyptians. It's interesting. We see that Joseph fits well within the framework of Egypt without sacrificing his personal character or faithfulness to God. Remind you in that sense of the man Daniel. Sometimes we as believers don't fit, but it's not for the right reasons. Here is a man who was faithful to God in every way, and yet he also can live within the framework. We don't find him saying, look, you can't embalm my father. Because just because you embalm here in Canaan, we don't embalm. In fact, we don't even believe in embalming. Because if God wanted us to embalm, he would have told us to embalm. And we don't embalm. Thanks. But he doesn't. This is the practice of the Egyptians. Fine. Let's embalm him. It would have been a slight to the Egyptians not to embalm him. So, verse 3, 40 days were required for it. For such is the period required for embalming. And incidentally, Joseph will be embalmed as well. And one of the commentators said that lends some excitement to the whole matter of archaeology. For someday maybe we'll find the mummies of Jacob and Joseph. Well, he's embalmed. Took 40 days. That was quite a process. You can get a book, Bible Encyclopedia or some such book, and read some interesting details if you like that kind of stuff on what they did when they embalmed them. I don't, so I didn't bring any material on it for you. I'm just satisfied to know he was embalmed. The Egyptians wept for him for 70 days. Now, the normal mourning period was 40 days while the embalming took place. The fact that the Egyptians mourned for Jacob for 70 days shows something of the honor he was held in Egypt, probably because of Joseph's position, because that is only 2 days less than the mourning period for a pharaoh. Average mourning period was 40 days. For a pharaoh, they mourned 72 days. For Jacob, they mourned 70 days. So he's held in honor and high esteem in the land of Egypt, and probably because of his son's position. In verse 7, Joseph takes a great entourage back to Canaan to bury his father. This is Jacob's first trip back to Canaan in 39 years. I'm sure it was quite an experience. I'm sure it made quite an impact on the people, and it did, and there's some reference to that. As the second highest ruler in the land of Egypt, that great empire, now is coming into Canaan, and with him are the chariots and the assembly of mourners and so on that would make that journey. Verses 15 to 21, Joseph speaks some on the providence of God. The brothers of Joseph are a little concerned. Now Jacob's gone. Maybe all of this friendliness, this 17 years of kindness on Joseph's part have only been because our father was alive. Now that our father's gone, he'll feel free to get rid of us too. So they say, and we no indication that anything has happened here except perhaps they made up the story, that we forgot to tell you just before Dad died, he wanted us to tell you, Joseph, please forgive the wicked sin of your brothers in selling you. And treat them kindly. And Joseph sees through this. And so at the end of verse 17, he wept. He's moved to tears. that they still don't trust him, that they still don't recognize that he sees the hand of God in this. And Joseph says in verse 19, "Do not be afraid, for am I in God's place?" Joseph always has things in proper perspective. He hasn't gotten a swelled head here, that he can rule Egypt and everybody there can bow down to him, but I don't stand in God's place. God's the one who's in charge. "As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good." Verse that we often quote and refer to, and we should. You ought to have it marked. "You meant it for evil, God meant it for good." That tells us something about how God works in our lives as his children. "You know, there is nothing but nothing that anyone can do to me or against me to frustrate God's purposes for me. The worst offenses, the greatest evil that could be done, in God's gracious plan for me will be used for good." That's true for every one of us as his children. What security, what confidence? In a world that seems to run out of control, where people think they're doing right as they blow other people away, as they slaughter people that have nothing to do with anything they're involved in, as well as all the other things that go on in the world, to know that no one can frustrate God's plan for me. They may mean it for evil against me, and the brothers did. All they wanted to do was be rid of Joseph. That was their evil plan. Did that mean evil for Joseph? No, it meant good for Joseph. Why? Because that was part of God's plan to elevate him. Oh, good for us to remember that as believers. That's why we need not worry about vengeance. We need not have thoughts of getting even. None of that. Why? Because the worst that someone might do to me, I can appreciate. God allowed that to come into my life because he wanted to use it for good in my life. They didn't mean that, but God did. Now, I say that now, and it's good to fix that in our mind now, because when you're going through it, it's much more difficult to have a biblical perspective. Joseph can say this now. I'm sure he struggled with it when he was languishing in a dungeon and wondered, what good is all this? What is being accomplished? How can God use this? Now we look back on it. So you fix it in your mind. God, I know whatever you do in my life will be right. It will honor you. It will be for my good. I'm satisfied with that. No matter what anyone else does to me, I appreciate the fact your purposes will be accomplished. And I rest secure in that. It takes all the fear out, doesn't it? What do I have to fear? My God is in control of everything, and I'm his child. So only what he allows for my good will come into my life. You meant it for evil. God meant it for good in order to bring about this present result, to preserve many people alive. So don't be afraid. Verses 22 to 26, the great man Joseph comes to the end of his earthly life. In verse 24, we're told in verses 22 and 23 that he lived to see his grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Joseph said to his brothers, "I'm about to die, but God will surely take care of you. Bring you up from this land to the land which he promised on an oath to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob." Then Joseph made the sons of Israel swear, saying, "God will surely take care of you. You shall carry my bones up from here." All the great life of the man Joseph, all the mighty things he did, the great position that he was given by God in the land of Egypt, you know what? When it comes to Hebrews chapter 11, the one event that God selects out of the life of Joseph to declare Joseph as a great man of faith is what he says here in verse 25. He wanted his bones taken out of the land of Egypt. Hebrews 11, 22. Again, that's remarkable to me. Puts things in perspective. Say, well, Joseph, he's a great man, a mighty man. Think of the faith it took to run Egypt and still be faithful to God. That's not what's selected out. The fact that he should trust God so much that now at the point of death, he knows he's going to die, he's going to be embalmed, he's going to bury in Egypt, and he's going to lay in that grave till there's nothing left of him but his bones. But he still believes God's going to take him back out to the land of Canaan, just like he promised. Now, that's faith. That is faith. So he says, don't you leave my bones down here. That's faith. You know, what do I want to leave my bones down here for? All the action's going to be in Canaan. I say, well, it won't really matter to you, Joseph. But it does matter. I'll just feel better knowing I'm being buried there, right in the middle of where God is going to bless his people. That's a statement of faith. And you know what? When the children of Israel leave Egypt, they stop and get Joseph's bones. Gee, how did they know? Well, you think when they buried Joseph, he wasn't buried in a significant place with a good grave marker? Was that to honor him? Sure. It was part of God's plan, so 400 years later, they'd know where to get his bones when it was time to leave. Great man of faith, going back to the land that God has promised. So what's significant about Joseph? Faith. In proper perspective. Great that he ruled Egypt. But really what makes him significant and what really counts about him is his faith in God. Isn't that why we're studying him in Genesis? We mentioned the name of the Pharaoh under which he ruled. Most of us don't even remember it now. But we all remember Joseph. Why? Pharaoh was greater. But Joseph was a man of faith. Important for me to remember that as a believer. What's going to count as God evaluates my life? My faithfulness to him. That's what will be the standard of measure. Not how big my church, not how well known I am, not how important my job, not how much money I had, but how faithful was I? Was I a man of faith? Think of that. Well, I can be a man of faith in any and every situation. That marks true greatness before God. That's what God selects out that marks Joseph off as a great man. Book of Genesis is closed, verse 26. Joseph died at the age of 110 years. He was embalmed and placed in a coffin in Egypt. I was like, boy, that's a sour note to end on. We start out in Genesis with a glorious creation, man placed in a garden. Sin enters, deterioration sets in, and in chapter 12, God selects out a people for himself. And the rest of the book of Genesis is about the developing and molding and shaping of that people. So even though it closes with Joseph in a coffin in Egypt, that's a reminder of what sin has done. We're also reminded that God's gracious redemption is at work because in Egypt, he is going to build the people for himself. As a testimony to the greatness of his redemption. Let's pray together.